Friday, November 2nd, 2012. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. This program will resume its two-hour format on Monday, November 5th. I think that RBN has that on their homepage at republicbroadcasting.org. Please visit my website at spingola.com to review the guest lineup for this program along with relevant links. During the program, email your questions or comments to spingola1 at yahoo.com. My regular email is deanna at spingola.com, but I do not look at that email during the program. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website, spingola.com, or by going to spingola.chatango.com. We are not going to take calls today. With just an hour, it is difficult for the guest to present his or her information. However, please feel free to email your questions. That is one of the features that I have really missed, and that is taking calls from the listeners. My guest today is Hans Krampe. Welcome to the program, Hans.
Hi, Deanna. Glad to be there.
I always enjoy hearing your voice. I just really do.
Likewise.
I've missed chatting with you.
You probably want to know about my latest exchange with Greg Felton.
We could talk about that. I do have some notes here about that. Or what did I do with my notes? Yes. That would be very good to talk about that. And let us know what else is going on in your life and what your thoughts are on what's going on in Canada. We'll just let it go where it wants to go.
Well, I have recently more and more encounters with Canadians who haven't got a clue what they're talking about, but have strong opinions and feel very self-satisfied and sure about themselves. And Greg Felton's exchange with ZCF. It is just a typical example of it. Here is Greg Felton, a young guy who wasn't even born at the time, pontificating about an era in a country that is halfway around the earth, that he has never been there, and I doubt he has ever been anywhere anyway, and is boneheadedly, pursuing his opinions and insisting that he is the expert on history, whereas everybody else doesn't know what he's talking about. Little does he know. I, for example, lived at the time. I was there. I saw what happened. I met all the people that were involved and heard their opinions and their experiences and what they recalled from the time. Greg Felton hasn't got a prayer. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right. Now we're talking about an article, an interchange that you can read about at ZionCrimeFactory.com between Greg Felton and Hans Krampe. And we do have to take a break, and we will be right back, and we can talk about this. And I don't think that he is any different than a lot of other people. So anyway, we'll be right back. Krampe, and he really doesn't need a website. He manages to get his voice out there and his very wise, not opinions, but knowledge. He has knowledge. He doesn't just have opinions. And there are a lot of people in this country who have opinions that are not based on any kind of knowledge at all. But Hans is quite different.
Yeah, I'm a great fan of ZCF. He doesn't know it really, or he didn't know it until I responded to Greg's exchange with him. But ZCF has produced an excellent compact compilation of National Socialism and Adolf Hitler's achievements and activities during the 30s and into the war. I mean, you can't divide one from the other, you know, because the enemies of Germany, National Socialist Germany, were already the enemies before Hitler became Chancellor of Germany.
So, oh, absolutely.
Greg Felton is a symptom that is very common among the general public in North America, including U.S. and Canada. And I felt that, you know, any time I have a chance to encounter someone like that, I feel like pouncing on them in revenge for all the insensitivity and temerity they display when they are talking about Adolf Hitler and National Socialism towards Germans. They have no sensitivity. They aren't even aware that they're being utterly offensive and ignorant. And so I stress that, you know, in the best way I can, to make them aware of their own shortcomings.
Right. And like you said, he's no different than a lot of other people. And he represents a lot of people who think the way he does. And and basically they are really adopting the government's version of every of that particular subject and of the of World War II. And yet these are the same people who would not believe the government about other issues. But somehow this is different.
Yeah, well, you know, this is another striking point. On every other issue, people are very critical and judgmental, rightfully so. But when it comes to Hitler, all of a sudden, all their common sense, all their rationality fades away and changes into blind faith because it's so inconvenient to research that issue, because it's hard to research. The actual facts are hidden, and you have to look for them, and you have to actually work to get at them. And people are not willing to spend the time and the effort. They want something that is regurgitated, something that's easily digested, that you can then, you know, absorb and then spout off as if you know something.
Right. That brings up a point. After 9/11, or well, before 9/11, I totally believe that they had a so-called truth movement already in place that would respond to any skeptics who did not believe the official version. But with World War II, they didn't have any kind of a group that would talk about this or say, oh, we don't believe that. So it has been very easy for people to accept whatever the government has disseminated about it.
Well, you know, people have been subject to propaganda, hate propaganda against Germans long before the Second World War started. That started already in the late 1800s in Britain, for example, where there were talk about if we destroy Germany tomorrow or today, tomorrow every Englishman would be richer, and Germany must be destroyed. You know, they used the Latin term, Germania esse delendam, and repeatedly. That is already long before the First World War started. So actually the anti-German hate propaganda started long, long before the First World War. Are you still there?
I muted myself. I'm sorry. I do that when I take a drink so people won't hear me gurgling water. Yes, that started probably around the time of the Socialist Revolutions in 1848.
You were talking about that people weren't unaware of, you know, that of the facts. In Germany, they were. The people that I met, my parents were aware of what happened in the 30s and 40s. And people I worked with that had been war veterans on the Eastern Front, they told me a few things. Not every German bought into the, denazification propaganda after the war, which was very strong, especially in West Germany. And another thing that happened was in West Germany, apparently the economy was cranked up after around 1950 or so, with the Marshall Plan, with something like $3 billion being invested rebuilding of the German economy. Well, East Germany didn't have that. And East Germany actually created from scratch an economy that was by the 1980s the fourth strongest economy in Europe. And when Germany was merged with West Germany and East Germany were merged into one unit, the American-dominated West German entrepreneurs went, and especially the banks, went into East Germany and simply plundered it ruthlessly, with no regard for people's lives, and acquired the industry, the commerce, the infrastructure for a penny on the dollar, so to speak. And today, East Germany is kind of a third world country within Germany.
Wow. Hans, when did you leave Germany and go over to Canada?
In 1974.
Oh, okay.
At that time, I still believed all the nonsense about Hitler and National Socialism because I had been, just as every other German who lives there, intensely brainwashed and indoctrinated, you know, not so much with a new ideology, but against accepting Adolf Hitler and National Socialism as something valuable.
Okay. Because I know
so
a lot
I
of
came over here believing it all and was, you know, I already then I could see the trends where Germany was headed. And that was, you know, to become a mirror image of the American way of life, and I hated it. You know, all of a sudden it was elbowing yourself through life, no consideration for the next guy, chasing after the buck. And that was something that I despised. I had actually grown up in East Germany as a kid, during my formative years. Rampant commercialism wasn't at all an issue.
Interesting. So when did you wake up? When did you decide to reevaluate things?
Well, I tried to become a patriotic Canadian. And the big awakening came with in 1983 when Brian Mulroney, the later Prime Minister of Canada, became the leader of the Conservative Party. And I was working up north in the mining camp, and our union president told me, "Hans, you watch out. You know that Mulroney? when he gets elected as the party leader of the Conservatives, he will probably become the Prime Minister of Canada, and that will be the end of Canada. And sure enough, he became the leader, he became the Prime Minister, and Lion Bryan went to town on Canada and started to dismantle all the social programs, privatize all the nationalized institutions of the country, claiming that only private business can do things properly and efficiently, and that a government-run institution is a millstone around the neck of the nation, and we can't afford our social programs anymore. We have to tighten our belts and make do with less, and all that stuff. It introduced a program of privatization that was rapidly reeled off. You know,
right.
one government organization after the other.
Hans, we do have to take a break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Today is Hans Krampe, that's K-R-A-M-P-E, and we had a caller call in and ask, and he wants to know your opinion on why World War I started in the first place.
Well, it's very easy, actually, if you know a little bit. Everybody is aware that the Crown Prince Franz Ferdinand of the Austrian Empire was assassinated in Yugoslavia at the time, and the Austrian government demanded an apology from the Yugoslavs, and they wouldn't give it. So then the Austrian government declared war on Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was aligned with France and England. So then France and England was involved, and Germany was had a friendship pact with Austria, so Germany was drawn into the war. Germany actually had nothing to do with the beginning of the war. It just was an unfortunate string of associations that started the First World War. But when the First World War was over, Germany was being declared as the cause of the war. And that harkens back to the British ambitions to destroy Germany, and not just Germany as a nation, but the German people. For that end, Britain had formed an entente with France. France used to be the traditional arch enemy of England, but not now. In order to destroy Germany, the friendship with the this pact with the with France came in really handy, and they started now to try to eliminate Germany as an economic power in the world. The whole First World War was simply based or grounded in greed, and getting rid of a very potent competitor, and that is what Germany was, had become in the late 1800s. When the war was over, then by declaring Germany as the cause of this confrontation, enabled then all the members that had fought against Germany to demand reparations for all the expenses that all the countries had encountered fighting this war, and more. It was then agreed upon at the Versailles Treaty to design the treaty in such a way that it was a continuation of the war by other means, economical. And it worked, you know, and if it hadn't been for Adolf Hitler, Germany would have been out of existence. It wouldn't have survived until 1945, I don't think.
Right, and don't you think that assassination of the Archduke was planned in order to provoke the war?
Yeah, there were connections. Gabriel Princip, the assassin, was later. I think he was defended by a lawyer who was associated with the Jewish organization. What's it called again? I forgot the name of it. Anyway,
it was a Black Hand, I think.
LICRA, I think. That organization was called LICRA, based in Paris, France.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that
was. He was a high-profile lawyer. A little guy like Princip couldn't have afforded his defense, but there he is defending Princip. I don't recall exactly how Princip wound up. I think he died of tuberculosis or something. He was a sick man when he had committed that assassination. So there is strong indication that the Jews were behind it, that they actually instigated Princip and prepared the ground for him to commit this assassination. I think the First World War was actually it started with a false flag, like the assassination of Crown Prince Franz Ferdinand.
Right.
Huh. So, but I got off the track there when I talked about Maroni and how you asked me how I got started with my unwashing my brain from denazification propaganda.
Right.
It was, you know, when Maroni started to practically dismantle Canada as we knew it. I expected Canadians to be up in arms and go on the street and really start to tear into this guy. But nothing happened. You know,
wow.
The most you could hear was, you know, little whimpers here and there. Oh, we have rights, and da-da-da-da-da. And you would have these demonstrations.
Hans, we do have to go to a break. We will be right back. So we'll pick it up on the other side.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Hans Krompe. So, okay, so tell us... Tell us about your experience in Canada.
Yeah, here I expected large demonstrations of protest taking place. Nothing of that kind happened. I remembered June 17, 1943, when the East German population as a unit rose up to demonstrate and protest against the oppressive regime that was dominated by the Russians there. And we were talking about millions of people spilling on the streets and fighting the Russian army, which was moving in with tanks and shooting at people. Well, obviously, Canadians have never experienced any real hardship in that kind of sense. And since that was not happening, and since then, I also discovered that the media were complicit with whatever the government was doing. They were practically the mouthpieces of government. That was the time, you know, when Arthur Topham and I started to form the Radical newspaper. And by writing for the Radical newspaper, we got responses, and some of these responses were from expatriate Germans who sent us material that I had never seen before about National Socialist Germany and Adolf Hitler. And at first I thought, these guys are nuts. But then eventually, when I really looked closely at the material that we received, I went on the Internet and started researching on this, and I got more and more information about it, and eventually, bit by bit, a comprehensive picture formed in my mind about what really happened in the 1930s and 1940s. And when I then also... then the argument would always start at 1933 when Hitler got into power, discarding all the events that took place before Hitler got into power. I didn't know that from Black Friday 1929 on, in Germany, suicide rates went up to the point where between 1931 and 1932, over 200,000 Germans committed suicide, and people were collapsing dead on the sidewalks from starvation. That's how bad things were in Germany. And, you know, then I started to look at Adolf Hitler with totally different eyes, because here you had a national emergency that was to call it catastrophic is an understatement. And then, I started to get interested. What caused all this? And what was happening in 1923 during the hyperinflation? Who caused the hyperinflation? And I researched that, and I found answers on that. And then who started the First World War? And who were the driving forces behind who instigated the First World War? And it all boiled down to Jews. Jews had their hands in banking. The banking were making profits from war. They were actually instigating wars. They were intransigent to any peace offers, you know, or peaceful negotiation. Especially as far as Germany was concerned, it was always stonewalling any peaceful effort that Germany was making. And that's how I got interested and started with the revising my understanding of history.
Interesting. Well, you know, we really don't put on demonstrate against anything, and when we read about what was going on in Germany between the World Wars and right after World War One, and how the communists came in, and how there was actually fighting in the street, since we've never experienced that.
I didn't know about that either. It was a civil war that in 1919.
Right.
The communists had begun to be organized already in 1916. And they were already then sabotaging the German war effort from behind the lines. And they were led by Jewish, Moscow-indoctrinated, financed, and equipped leaders that gained influence over the German unions. And they then ingathered them into the Communist Party of Germany. And when the war had ended, they started to really go down go to town on Germany and taking over power, because at that point 6 million union members had now become Communist Party members, and they were fighting to take over Germany by violent means, by force of arms. And they had already succeeded in Bavaria, where they began to disown people. They would invade people's homes and take everything they found in there and said, under the argument that private property wouldn't exist anymore, and anybody who resisted was simply shut down. I mean, it was gruesome what happened in Bavaria, especially in Munich at the time. And Adolf Hitler was so disgusted what he found there. He looked around for what could be done about it. And he knew a lot of vets from the First World War, and they formed the Freikorps. And the Freikorps, even though they were a minority compared to the communists were far superior in terms of numbers, but they were the Freikorps was disciplined, and they had arms, access to arms, and they started to fight the communist takeover of Germany by violent force, and they succeeded. And the assassination of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht put an end to to the advances of the Communist Party. But the Communist Party still was there to
take over the country. They wanted to take over the country. They wanted to communize the country. They had infiltrators.
They wanted to do this. They couldn't do it by entirely violent force anymore, because they lost the allegiance of the German people. The German people got kind of a little bit careful about what the communists were doing. And that was also the time when Adolf Hitler started to form the National Socialist Party in Munich. And then the Communist Party tactics changed. They started to interfere and sabotage in little actions here and there and with propaganda, and especially intimidation of new parties, especially the National Socialists were intimidated, or they tried to intimidate them by busting into gatherings, mass,
into their
mass assemblies of the National Socialists, or the National Socialists tried to get their point across in relatively small venues, and the communists would bust in and started beating up brutally, with clubs and broken bottles and what have you. And there was actual fighting happening, and shots were fired, and people died. Hundreds of National Socialists died. And that was after the SA was formed as a protective measure against constant communist violent attacks.
Wow.
Since the communists had an agenda to destroy, to make Germany a Soviet of Moscow, they were clearly a subversive element that was bent on destroying Germany as a nation from the east. And you got to also see this in the background of the 1917 revolution in Russia that was happening now, and that the Russian revolution aimed to take over the world by violent means. And what happened in Germany then was part of that. And Hitler opposed that. He recognized that the Russian Revolution was totally dominated by Jews. He also was clear about, or had gained knowledge about what happened during the First World War, and then in the post-war period, resulting into the hyperinflation and then the clamor of foreign investors, mainly Jewish financiers, taking over and buying German wealth at the penny on the dollar. You know, the industry was bought up, the agricultural land was bought up, whole city blocks were bought up. They were making money hand over fist from the misery of the German people, and the Jews were dominant in this scenario. And so here again, the communists were dominated by Jews, the financiers were dominated by Jews, and that Hitler knew about it, was vocal about it, and informed the German people about it, that is what made him so unpopular right from the start. And I think that is why to this day Hitler is so demonized and vilified, especially or almost exclusively by the Jews.
Well, that's interesting. As you were talking, I was thinking about the very, very early riots that were in this country during the 1800s. And basically the government attacked these people with the military forces and really taught the people in this country not to do that. And so people, you know, they might go downtown and hold up placards and things, but they really don't exercise any kind of, force. And yet in Germany, they really could recognize what was going on. And the only thing that would work was fighting them one-to-one, with using force, correct?
Yeah, fighting them by military means, you know. And if you are not an organized military, you fight them with whatever you got. People realize that, in general, government is not the friend of people. The government is the enemy of people. And the governments always struggle or make every attempt to extend their powers and their influence beyond what they need to govern. So I agree with J.B. Campbell, for example, who says that, the government is your enemy and the agencies of the government, the police, the FBI, and here in Canada, the RCMP, and the Canadian Armed Forces.
Any kind of force that is used against the people is wrong. Because, initially the FBI was supposed to be investigating criminality in the country. But now when you look at the police force, I don't believe that we should go out and shoot these people. I wouldn't go that far but definitely we need to recognize what their function is, and it is not good. It is designed to keep the people in line. And when you consider that the government was supposed to represent us, that the government, that we hired the government, well, we didn't hire all this force to come back and attack us and to steal our property and do all the other things that they are doing. So things have certainly got out of hand, and they infiltrated, the communists have infiltrated us since right after the so-called Civil War. But yet in Germany, they would not allow that. They tried to infiltrate there, but they would not tolerate that, which is pretty good, pretty wonderful.
Well, this was, thanks to Adolf Hitler, they started to, put an end to communist intimidation and violent takeover of Germany. That was only because Adolf Hitler was there. If Adolf Hitler hadn't been there, I doubt if things had come to this point. And besides, there's the argument that Hitler was a tyranny, a dictatorship. Now, I personally distinguish between a dictatorship and a leadership. in my mind, Adolf Hitler's method to govern was not a dictatorship. It was a leadership, and it was based on democratic principles. And he applied direct democracy, governing by referenda. All important issues were decided by the people through referenda, internationally supervised. And the amazing thing was, since people at the time had access to alternative information, and Adolf Hitler was a great speaker, as everybody knows. He was charismatic and powerful in his speeches, and he told people facts, the truth. He didn't bullshit them. He didn't make phony promises, and people clued in on that. This is at a time when there was no TV, and radio just started to become a popular means of listening in and disseminating news. But it wasn't widespread.
All right. Okay, we do need to take a break. We'll be right back. Hans Krampe, that's K-R-A-M-P-E, and anyway, we've got about 4 minutes.
Well, talk about the FBI. It has changed into a force of menace for the people, and you said you shouldn't go out and kill them. I mean, I agree, you don't go out and deliberately kill people looking for enemies. But if the FBI comes to your home and invades it by violent force, without a search warrant, without reason, and starts to, you know, kill people and whatever, then it's too late to do something about it. Then you are alone, and all you can do is defend yourself with whatever you got, because eventually they kill you. And if they don't kill you, they ruin your life. And so what's the solution? There has to be an armed resistance. J.B. Campbell is right. The point has developed beyond return. You have to face up to the fact that you cannot avoid violent confrontation anymore unless you are tired of life and you want to be killed.
Wow. Well, I fully agree that we must protect ourselves, that we must defend ourselves, and I believe that that every person should own a gun and know how to use it. But I don't think that I would go out and start shooting people up just because they're cops or something. And I think that's kind of the implications that he has made.
Well, you see it the wrong way around. You know, you got to see it. You are being attacked by people out there.
Oh, yes.
Who are way better equipped, who are trained to attack you.
Oh, yes.
And have no
qualms
of doing that.
Right. So I agree with defending myself, but I wouldn't go out and start anything.
Yeah. Well, nobody in his right mind would, you know. But on the other hand, waiting until the fight is being carried to you, to their advantage.
Right.
It's not the way to go either.
Right. I think a lot of people assume that at some point in time the military will start defending the people against the government, but I think that the military is so indoctrinated that they will work for the government and they will start shooting the citizens.
Well, there seems to be a change among the officer corps. I'm not talking about the brass, you know, the generals, but among the officer corps and the lower ranks, there seems to be a kind of change of mind about what their purpose is. You see a lot or hear a lot about soldiers who are totally disgusted with what they are being used for.
Oh, absolutely. They're being exploited for, you know, the corporations are exploiting them. They're going over there and seizing assets and guarding poppy plants and all, you know, all kinds of things. And that's not what they signed on for. As we've run out of time, it's been delightful visiting with you again.
That's too short.
It is. Well, my program is going to 2 hours starting Monday, so we'll have to have you back.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, Diana, thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you on Monday.